Welcome to Pain Talk, where we explore pain through a modern, science-based lens. We break down how pain really works, why it can persist, and what helps the nervous system begin to feel safe again, because pain is real. But so is change.
Welcome back to Pain Talk. Today we're tackling one of the most complex and emotionally charged issues in medicine, the prescribing of opioids. Once called God's own medicine, opioids were a cornerstone of pain care. Today, the landscape has shifted. Prescribing has declined across Canada. Guidelines are tighter. Clinicians are more cautious, and many patients with chronic pain feel caught in the middle. So the question is, have we corrected or have we swung the pendulum too far and overcorrected? Joining me today is Dr. David Gerling, whose recent CMAJ article challenges us to think carefully about where we are and where we're going when we're prescribing opioids. In this conversation, we'll explore the tension between safety and suffering, between evidence and fear, and between policy and the lived experience of patients. Because behind every prescription and every restriction is a person trying to live their life.
Hey, Maureen, how are you?
Hey, David. Hi, how are you? So yes. When I saw this article, because my training is eMERGE palliative care, but I also do addiction and chronic pain, but I'm also the physician for prescription monitoring in the province. And so I have tons of conversations with prescribers, especially around controlled substances. And I'm always interested in picking the brains of the experts in this area. I remember the first time I heard you talk was actually at one of the gatherings around the opiate crisis. And I thought,
maybe
wow.
In Ottawa, the minister had this. Yeah.
To me, I thought it was awesome because it was so refreshing to hear someone talk about it. You did. You know, it was really important. But I have some perspectives as well but I'm just curious about sort of picking your brain around this as well and why I think, because I think those of us that do the work in this area kind of learned really early on that, because as a palliative care physician, eMERGE doc, I can't do my job without opioids, right?
Yeah.
But very quickly you realize
as an internist, same here.
But I learned, so my area of expertise, actually, I set up a methadone prescribing program in our community mostly around palliative care. And so, of course, you start getting all these referrals on patients with chronic pain, whether or not methadone would be a possible treatment. And you very quickly realize that chronic pain is a different beast, totally. And when you start to dive into it a little bit more, you start to understand that. But I'm just curious, we're going to just start with one question that, you know, what's your opinion, whether or not opioids are a life-saving medicine, you know, God's own medicine, or they're a dangerous liability, which is the devil's brew, right? What do you think?
The truth is somewhere in between. So yeah. I'm a hospital-based internist. I prescribe opioids all the time. I just do it very differently than I did, say, 20 years ago, back in the heyday. Were you practicing in the 2000s?
Oh yeah. Like I had been in practice for 40 years.
Yeah. I finished at Dal in 94. So I've been an internist for just shy of 30 years. I think, they're not life saving except in a subset of patients who have become dependent on them and who could very easily become suicidal if the drugs were taken away or the dose dropped too quickly. I think they're a liability insofar as doctors aren't very good at approaching. I don't mean to sound disparaging, but I think there's a bit of a philosophical discussion that has to be had here. And maybe I'm not sure how long this podcast is meant to go, but I can describe a patient of mine from last week. And I think it's really helpful to think about why we give patients pain medication. So here's the story in a nutshell. 62-year-old man, fairly medically well, is at home sitting in front of his computer, has a violent sneeze, and then develops excruciating low back pain, has to be helped to the couch by his family. He takes a couple of Robaxacet tablets, and there's some Percocet in the house, takes two of those in the evening, goes to sleep and is no better the next day, is brought by the fire department to our ED. And in the ED, he got a total of, I think, 6 of hydromorph IV from the eMERGE docs, didn't do anything. It was admitted to me, he couldn't walk. I mean, this guy was, you've seen patients like this, right? He couldn't, not only could he not walk, even moving around in the stretcher was just unbelievably uncomfortable. And so We put him on acetaminophen, then an NSAID, and some hydromorph, and ketamine. And ketamine's what made the difference for him. I think we don't use nearly enough
Interesting.
Ketamine in the hospital. And he went home. He was standing the next day with physio, went home like on day four. But one of the questions I ask, in fact, this is a question I ask my medical students and residents all the time, but I think I could put the question to anybody listening to this podcast. Just imagine yourself on that stretcher. You're the patient in the stretcher. You can't move. And he's got just a L3-4 disc bulging on his thecal sac. And that's the cause of his pain. We're going to reach for a pain med or two. And I want people to think about what we're trying to accomplish. And when I ask my med students and my residents, what are you trying to accomplish? They say, well, we're trying to get his pain down. I said, okay, sure. And no one is going to argue. If we get his pain from a 10 down to a 3 or a 4, that's a huge win. What are you really trying to accomplish? And then their head will tilt a little bit like they're a dog has heard a funny sound, and they kind of think it might be a trick question. I said, we're trying to improve function. I said, okay, what else? And they said, and so they're exhausting the hypothesis space, you know, avoid discharge or decrease length of stay, you know, return to work, improve quality of life, all those things. And I said, excellent. Those are all things that we're trying to accomplish. But what are we really, when you step back to 38,000 feet, what are we really trying to do? Sometimes they land on the answer, but here's what I think the answer to that question is. We're going to give this patient a medication, and the overarching goal of therapeutics, that medication, we're giving it with the hope of helping everything, pain, function, and so on. But it is a medication, and so it by definition comes with some potential harms. And so what we're really trying to do, and this is the overarching goal of therapeutics more generally, we are trying to afford the patient more benefits than harms. And it sounds so obvious, like why would you even say such a thing? I think the reason why it has to be said is because we can only know if we've done that, A, after we've given the patient the drug. So we are, in a very real sense, experimenting on a living human being. We are giving a medication or two or three or four with this goal. But we're only going to be able to know if we have helped more than harmed, if we have a good handle on the harms. And this is what I was about to say a few minutes ago. We're just not very good at that. We're not very good, we think we are, at identifying the harms that our medications for pain can cause. And especially when it comes to opioids and to a lesser extent NSAIDs, we are not as good as we think. And the final point I'll make here, because this always comes up, it is obviously true that the balance of benefits and harms in any given patient, as you increase the dose and increase the dose and increase the dose, that's obviously going to tilt in an unfavorable direction. So back to your question about are opioids, we've all seen patients have tremendous response to opioids, and they're valuable drugs, but I think that they are at their best, they're at their pharmacologic best in the early days of therapy, because with continued treatment, as little as 5 to 10 days, and certainly with ongoing therapy, and certainly as the dose goes up, the side effects that we aren't good at catching intensify, and it's very easy for a well-meaning doctor to transition a patient from someone who's benefiting from opioids to someone who's actually, whether they realize it or not, being harmed by a drug that was started a few months ago or a few years ago. So that's a long-winded kind of philosophical answer to your question. But I see your finger up. I'm going to stop talking.
No, it's okay. Yeah. I'm just trying so hard because you bring up a couple of really important points. Mm-hmm. So how I frame it for students is I said, opioids are not personal. It's really about biology. So when you're seeing patients, you're risk stratifying all of the therapies that you use. So I always put opioids in the same category as anticoagulation. So when I'm making a decision about using an opioid, I'm looking at the patient's risk factors. I'm looking at the pathology. I'm sort of trying to balance the harm and benefit, knowing that this might be a patient that may actually have more harm versus benefit. But sometimes we end up using the therapy, but sort of managing that risk for the patient. The other piece that you bring up that's really important, David, is the biological mechanism, I think, matters. To me, chronic pain is a biological mismatch for opioids and for lots of reasons. I mean, especially if you look at the biological mechanism, you know, nociceptive versus centrally mediated, but also how we know, you know, when we look at those reward pathways about, because a patient with chronic pain is craving pain relief. They want relief of their pain, and the brain is going to know really quickly what's going to work and what's not going to work. And so it makes sense to me that they navigate to these therapies because they're so effective. And I know as a prescriber, I can't compete with them. But and I think the other thing that's really important is you're talking about two different populations, that opioid naive patient and that legacy patient.
Oh, this is a critical distinction.
Yeah. And to me, where we do harm is with the legacy patient. We have a beautiful opportunity to do it right in the patient that's opioid naive, that we've exhausted all of the therapies. But what I find generally is that most clinicians, they don't like having conversations around how we manage risk when we're talking about a condition that often has significant suffering, you know, that pain and suffering piece, when it's not personal. It's really an agent, a tool that we can use that carries significant risk. Yeah.
You raised a lot of points. I just want to double click on a couple of things you said. So you at the outset, you mentioned sort of tailoring the therapy to the patient, in the sense that I think what you said was you're essentially in your patient level experiment where you're trying to help more than harm. The patient's past history or other attributes might influence what you choose. So if this patient with the sneeze and the lumbar pain had been discharged from hospital 2 weeks ago with an upper GI bleed and had a creatinine clearance of 20 mils a minute, I would never have touched him with an NSAID. I would have said to myself, I would have done the calculus, and I would have said, hey, this is a guy where obviously I'm going to risk harming more than helping with an NSAID. That same thing applies with opioids. It's more complicated, because let's take a patient, let's imagine somebody who had a history of opioid use disorder, and they were on OAT for a while, and maybe they came off, and maybe they're not methadone anymore. There's somebody who, if they present with pain, I would think twice about using an opioid in that patient. That's a patient who, just by virtue of their past history, is going to be at higher risk of getting into trouble with an opioid, or someone who had maybe a history of childhood trauma, sexual abuse, or something like that. That's a well-established risk factor for developing opioid use disorder. But I think it's even more complicated, because even in a patient who doesn't have any kind of red or yellow flags of any kind, I think we are still, there's so many harms of opioids that we're just not, that get their teeth into the patient right away, that tolerance, dependence, which I think is a distinct construct from addiction. Mm-hmm. Not everyone agrees with me, but I think they're pretty.
No, I agree totally with you. Yeah.
Hyperalgesia.
I expect dependency. I expect tolerance. I expect withdrawal.
Right.
You know,
well,
opiate use disorder, I always frame as a life-threatening complication. Yeah. It's not a moral or ethical failing. That's why we need to monitor and risk stratify.
Right.
So rather than see addiction as the patient's fault, in many ways, it's actually our responsibility. Just like I'm trying to prevent a major bleed from anticoagulation, am I going to be 100% correct all the time? No.
Yeah.
But I am responsible when I choose with that patient to use a high risk medication, especially in a high risk patient. And I'm talking about usually patients under the age of 40, right? That's the highest risk population, is that I'm going to manage that risk with the patient, having those conversations. And the clinicians are not, they're not having the conversations or monitoring. There's a lot of hesitancy.
They're hard conversations to have. The other point you made that was really important was the distinction. There are three kinds of people in this world. There are people who aren't on opioids yet. There are people who are on opioids for chronic pain. We'll call them legacy patients. And then there are people with opioid use disorder. And let's acknowledge that there's no small amount of overlap between those latter two categories. Some people like to pretend there's some, you know, bright light, some bright line that divides those two groups of patients. But there is no small amount of overlap there. And I think our biggest gains in terms of opioid prescribing are with the opioid naive group, where, you know, in 2005, you know, we would think nothing of just starting opioids and continuing them. And as the analgesia might attenuate in the months that followed, going up on the dose, as if you didn't pay a price on the side effect side of things when you did that, as if tolerance itself, the attenuation of analgesia, wasn't an important side of it. It's obviously a side effect. It only happens because the drug is started. and the drugs become less effective. You know, we escalated historically. This is one of the things I think we did to the great detriment of millions of people in North America is just mindlessly, that's probably too harsh, is just liberally increase the dose in response to inadequate analgesia in a way that we would do with no other drug, right?
Yeah. But in a way that we would never do as a palliative care physician. You know, they'll say from the beginning in your training is you never medicate, you know, you need to understand what you're medicating to. To me, opioids are very strategic, how I use them. I mean, I very rarely get into, you know, higher doses than 200 milligram morphine equivalent before I'm doing an opiate rotation. So for me, it was confusing for me to see these.
I never
really
do that anymore. I never go to that. I think, exactly.
You do the rotate because it's a lot easier to do the rotation, but you also look at because the thing that I can find that I find helpful, I use this concept called a threat landscape. So, and the way to explain this is almost to think about how our pain system works. And I don't mean to kind of dumb it down, but it's just a really interesting way to think about it. And when I'm trying to explain it to patients, so our pain system is very similar to how a smoke detector works, right? So the inputs are basically your heat and smoke, but the heat and smoke are not the loud noise that the smoke detector makes. They have to be processed in that smoke detector before that loud noise is made. Mm-hmm. And so that loud noise doesn't really tell us where the threat is. It really is just telling us to go look. So our pain system, threat detection system works the same way, but our threats are coming biologically, right? We have biological threats plus those threats that are coming from the central nervous system. And unfortunately, what can happen is a lot of this pharmacology can actually increase the threat landscape of the patient. So by themselves, they're not going to increase pain. Mm. But, you know, when they get processed into the brain and depending on memory, that learned experience, whatever, you know, that association that starts to happen is that the output is going to be pain. Pain is just the output. It's not personal. It's just it's a protective output, right, that all humans produce. And sometimes through no fault of the patient, pain itself can actually become part of that threat landscape. And so pain starts to link to very benign things. So even feeling the sensation of pain actually increases the output of pain rather than seeing it as a normal protective mechanism. And so that in that way, that's how I find opioids in many ways, just because of their pharmacokinetics, actually increase the patient's threat landscape metabolized.
Not the metabolism so much as, I mean, the part of the brain that's sort of the smoke detector here is the amygdala. And what people may not realize, you know, this is well studied. 30 days of morphine for low back pain will shrink the gray matter in your amygdala by about 3 to 4%. This has been studied.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So these drugs change the structure and the function of the central nervous system, as benzos do, as alcohol does, as SSRIs can do. But I think. One of the, and this is a point, we've got a lot of concepts that we're talking about here. One of the points I want to make is when we go back to, and it's about the harms of opioids. This might be the most important thing. Your audience is mostly physicians or patients or both?
It's both. Yeah. Okay. There's any prescriber plus patients.
Okay. So this is, I think, maybe the most important point that I try to make to my trainees and colleagues and my patients. Think back to what I said a second ago about us trying to balance the benefits and harms. And one of the harms, you know, any self-respecting medical student, when I say what are the potential downsides of opioids, they'll say sedation and constipation and pruritus and maybe nausea. And if you take too much, your breathing will slow and you can become sleepy and you can even die. And those are the easy side effects. The hard side effects, the ones that we don't recognize so readily, that tend to become more problematic with long-term use, you know, hyperalgesia, hormonal effects with decreased testosterone and decreased cortisol and central sleep apnea and motor vehicle collisions and depression and so on. But if I had to pinpoint what I think is the most pernicious of all of the side effects of opioids, it's dependence. And just because people get this confused all the time. And so I want to spend a minute just unpacking my thoughts on this because I think it's pretty important. So to me, dependence is an expected adaptive consequence of being on opioids. And it is defined by the emergence of withdrawal symptoms when the drug is lowered, the dose is lowered, or the drug's taken away. And we've all seen people with opioid use disorder who have gone without their opioids and they've got classic dope sickness. But the point I want to make about patients, and by the way, the legacy patients obviously are intensely dependent, and as are the patients with opioid use disorder. But the cellular events that underlie dependence begin with the very first dose. There are several studies that show us this. And so back to our helping more than harming. Imagine my guy with back pain at the outset of this. Let's say that I had just put him on Hydromorph and maybe an NSAID and sent him home. And with 14 days of hydromorphone, he took it around the clock and, you know, was functioning okay. But on day 14, you know, he stopped and ran out. He would feel miserable. He would have obvious opioid withdrawal. And guess what? If he went back to a doctor, came back to see me or see his family doc and had his opioids resumed, all of that misery would melt away. And so he would very reasonably come to believe that opioids are helping him, when in fact what they are doing is keeping withdrawal at bay, keeping at bay a withdrawal syndrome that is itself the result of the drug. So I look after a lot of patients with cancer on my ward.
Yeah.
I don't escalate. Sometimes I do, but I think it's got to be said that once you get above, you know, 90, 100, maybe 120 milligrams of morphine equivalent per day, those patients are intensely dependent, and some or even most of the benefit that they get from ongoing therapy, it's not analgesia. It's keeping withdrawal at bay and keeping withdrawal-related hyperalgesia at bay. So that's why I think docs don't appreciate, A, just how quickly dependence develops, B, that it becomes more consequential as the dose goes up and as the duration of therapy continues, and C, and this is the hardest part of all, appreciating that the patient, especially the legacy patients, are a good example of this. Someone who's been on, you know, 200 of morphine for 10 years, well, they are horribly dependent. They absolutely need the medication to function. And you can understand why they bristle at the thought that this medication isn't actually helping them. I think what it's doing is keeping at bay a withdrawal syndrome that if we had time machining, could go back and either not use opioids or use them much more sparingly, those patients would very frequently be much better off. They don't like hearing it, but it's true.
Yeah. But it also reinforced. So when I think about the dopaminergic pathways, how they get hijacked by the brain. So, you know, normally dopamine obviously is helping us move forward, right? It's that chemical that really helps us. I mean, I think about it as towards motivation. It sort of gets us looking forward to our life. And what often happens in the patient with chronic pain is that the focus of dopamine is really on staying out of pain and preventing pain from getting worse. So that's how they get stuck. And so the opioid is actually keeping them there as well.
I think they get stuck because of the therapy. I mean, they get stuck.
Oh,
I think
totally.
The opioid not just amplifies the pain, but they're stuck on a therapy that they can't be. I shouldn't have interrupted you. I'm sorry, Maureen.
I think we're on the same page. We're talking to the converted here, but it's really, for me, it's about stepping back and sort of really understanding what we're trying to do with this tool, because it isn't really, for me, it becomes very personal, because obviously the patient, I mean, when we're looking at chronic pain in particular, we know that fear of worsening pain is a huge factor, and that anticipation, that pain anticipation. Pardon me. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's reinforced with withdrawal, and so it actually keeps the patient in this vicious cycle. The other thing I wanted to ask you, because one of the observations that I made, especially when I started doing a lot more chronic pain work, is how patients who are living with chronic pain often focus more on the immediate release opioids versus long acting. So if I had a patient living with, you know, with a life limiting condition who was, you know, obviously we're starting them at immediate release and then we're switching them over to get better pain control, knowing that obviously they may need increases. But what I found with the chronic pain population is there was a tremendous amount of resistance to switch over to long acting, even when you tried to help them understand how that short acting could probably be reinforcing some of this, this fear of worsening pain, right? It keeps your brain very focused on the pain. Huh. I'm just wondering, and I've seen a few papers on this, but I would love to, because it was a very, I mean, that's the beauty of working in these different areas, is you just like this is really interesting that this happens. So often they don't find the long-acting effective. They find their pain is worse. Yeah. So I don't know if that's around the pain anticipation, you know, how the brain is so focused.
I think it's complicated. I almost never now prescribe long-acting opioids. I think, and I can unpack why that is, if you like, in a minute. One of the problems with long-acting opioids, and we saw this clearly with OxyContin back in the day, is it was supposed to last 12 hours. And for a vast majority, for actually depends on the study, for a sizable subset of patients, the drug is gone by sort of eight
hours. Yeah.
And so those last few hours, these patients are miserable and they're watching the clock, waiting for their next dose. And which is why we often would prescribe the stuff TID 3 times a day. And maybe the reason why some patients prefer the immediate release is because it is what's going to salvage them, get them out of the withdrawal that they might just perceive as worsening pain. Right.
I mean, well, they're not. I don't. What I notice in the population is they don't understand withdrawal. You know, if I'm working with a population where, you know, they developed a substance use disorder from the non-medical use of an opioid, say from illicit mm-hmm. supply versus the medical use of an opioid, mm-hmm. People that develop it from an illicit supply, they understand withdrawal. You know, they'll talk about pill sick, the language that they use, all that. But in the chronic pain population, they don't even understand the withdrawal concept until you explain it to them.
I think this is actually a really good point, because the drug was started for pain and it initially helped their pain, and it very quickly became the case that they need the drug to not feel sick. And part of that not feeling sick is suppression of some of the pain. But it doesn't take long before, as I said before, the main benefit is keeping at bay the withdrawal. And one of the key features of withdrawal is hyperalgesia, it's worsening of pain. But I think a lot of these patients, the chronic pain, the legacy patients, and I don't mean to put all chronic pain patients in the same group. I guess I'm talking about the ones who are on opioids chronically.
Yeah,
they know that they are only just one or two missed doses away from abject misery. And and that's, I mean, that itself is pretty telling.
But don't they understand that anyway? So chronic pain, by definition, what I always say to patients, with acute pain, I mean, physicians look for patterns, right? It's got a very specific pattern. It makes sense that the pain would be there, mm-hmm. like your guy with the sneeze and the back pain. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the chronic pain populations, clinically, there is no pattern. It often is very unpredictable. From day to day, they don't know. So even in that unpredictability, the opioid itself gets meshed into that, they just can't plan, right? They're not showing, but I'm not sure if they understand the impact that the medication is having on that threat landscape, how it's contributing to more pain, because their brain is going to try and make sense of it, right? So if they believe, you know, that because they have degenerative disc disease, that's why their pain is so unpredictable, then they're not going to make that association with the opioid at all. They're not going to see. And it's, I don't even mean to pick on opioids, just that we're talking opioids. But I mean, if you're medicating to sedation, that also increases their threat landscape, right? Because the brain is not going to feel safe moving.
NSAIDs aren't going to amplify pain, gabapentinoids, anticonvulsants, any of the things you might kind of sprinkle into the patient. Opioids are the one class of drugs, maybe there's another one, but that's the one, the most common one, that can very clearly amplify pain. And I should go back to my point a moment ago about why I almost never use long-acting opioids. And it's because, and I've only kind of landed on this kind of thinking over the last maybe 5 or 7 years, all the side effects that I think we're not really good at detecting. I gave the long litany of them earlier, but let's put dependence chief among them. They are all a consequence of stimulating mu opioid receptors. All the post receptor stuff that happens, all the G protein, we can get all pointy headed if you want. But when you put someone on a long acting opioid or a fentanyl patch is maybe even the best example, the patient's mu receptors are just being constantly bathed in mu agonist. So we take this receptor system, this highly evolved receptor system that's evolved over hundreds of thousands of years, and isn't just involved in pain, but in reward and bonding and emotions. And we come along with good intentions. We come along with good intentions, and we flood it with massively super physiologic concentrations of exogenous agonists, and we don't expect bad things to happen. So I think that to the extent that intermittent sparing use of opioids allows the receptor a bit of a breather, it allows a bit of recovery and a bit of a change in the regulation, just like you might sometimes give small doses of naltrexone for centrally mediated pain. It's kind of almost counterintuitive that you give an opioid antagonist for some sort of central sensitization pain. It's the same general phenomenon. You block the receptor for a few hours overnight, and you let things kind of normalize a little bit, and you've got a more robust response to your own endogenous endorphins and enkephalins.
Do you think that's actually happening, though, David? So I think I understand what you're saying in terms of the short, because I mean, that point about short acting versus long acting, for me, I just from a palliative care head, it makes no sense for me to leave patients on very high doses of, because these are often patients that are on very high morphine equivalents that I'm not talking about small amounts, right? And these are patients that are very, very dependent, very tolerant. Yeah. And clinically, especially when you're looking at, 240 milligram morphine equivalent of immediate release, I clinically, even though it's almost impossible to switch the patient.
I see what you're saying. I think when you get up to doses like that, first of all, I think we should try not to do that. I mean,
not what's happening.
I know. So I think when you're on doses like that, first of all, your immediate release is not very practical. Second question that needs to be confronted is how much of that patient's pain is from the drugs we put them on? Yeah. And I think the answer is one we don't want to hear more often than not. It's hard to quantify. No counterfactual. You don't have the identical twin in the next bed on. But so if I've got a patient who's dying with metastatic prostate cancer or mesothelioma or some other some horrible painful condition, do I use opioids? Yeah, but I really try to optimize the multimodal approach. I use a lot of ketamine, and again, this is in hospital, and we have a very straightforward. Ketamine is just, does it always work? No, but then neither do opioids or NSAIDs or anything else. Yeah. But what I like about ketamine is if you think back to the helping more than harming. It's really, really hard to hurt people with low doses of ketamine. And so, and it's a wonderful part of a multimodal kind of approach. So I try to avoid escalating doses like that.
Yeah. Sometimes. We use a lot of ketamine, mostly for procedural sedation. And I do find it, becomes problematic is that I do see an escalation of use in the community, but it's also done in conjunction with opioids, in conjunction I'm asking myself, how is this helping? So I always say to prescribers, pills do not build because our patients, so patients who are living with chronic pain, they don't lack motivation or willpower to do well. They are working super hard to get better. What they lack is an understanding of what chronic pain is and the tools that they need to help them make progress. So pills don't build skills, which we found, from the evidence, just like we've found just recently from Jason Busey's interventional study, because I think the same principles apply around legacy patients versus those patients you're going to do the intervention in. But what they can do is they can lower that high intensity of pain down to a moderate. So you can bring in skills, you can bring in the knowledge piece, right? Because when you're in that high intensity all the time, your brain is feeling way too much threat. Right? It just cannot process information. So for me, pills are really not about, honestly, they're not even about the pain so much as is bringing down that threat landscape enough, not too much, but that so I can bring in other types of skills that evidence is telling us are going to help that patient. Now, they're not as sexy as pills, obviously. And patients are going to look at you with six heads.
And they're not as easy. I mean, pills are easy and they're paid for. And,
exactly.
I think that's a worthwhile point. A lot of we don't talk enough about the non-pharmacologic approaches to pain because, first of all, they're harder and a pain psychologist might not be covered. And weight loss is easy to talk about, but it's hard to do.
Well, it's not even, David, there's so much resource online now. I don't know if you saw the recent paper I think it was Elliot Weiss out of Canadian Family Physician. They did a really good job. So we now know that pain reprocessing therapy is considered a level one therapy. Yes. So I've done the training both in level one, level two, but I'm not a therapist, but I tell you, I use those techniques in my Emerge hat, my palliative care hat, my chronic chronic pain hat, my addiction hat.
And so the study from 2021, I was just stunned by the effect of that. I mean, effectively.
It works. It's crazy. Yeah. So when you see it, once people start to understand, you know, like understand what's actually happening within their pain system, why they've developed this life-changing, life-shifting condition that no one can seem to tell them what, because they are working super hard. And I think that's a mistake that we make as well as healthcare providers. We assume that the patient's not trying hard enough. I mean, like, they're the hardest working group of people I've ever worked with. They will do whatever you tell them. If you tell them to walk 15 minutes twice a day, they'll do it. But what's going to happen? It's going to make their pain worse because that brain has linked pain to those benign activities. So how we even approach how we get them moving is a total shift, right? It's a total different way.
Just retraining the brain to interpret chronic pain as non-threatening.
Yeah, and it's like I tell people, we're not trying to change your pain, believe it or not. What we're trying to do is change your relationship, because we can't control when pain comes up, just like we can't control anxiety or anything else. But what we want to do is change that relationship. Yeah. So rather than moving away from it, which is reinforcing that fear, right, that we provide you with tools that feel safe in that moment. Yeah. And that gets a bit complicated because most of our patients, as you know, and I don't need to tell you this, have a lot of, you know, there's significant adverse childhood experiences. There's a lot of trauma in those backgrounds, just like you see with substance use. So, you know, there is some complexity, but it's not complicated. I mean, it really, when you start to understand it just from a survival perspective, and what makes it complicated is not the neurobiology from my perspective. It's mostly that we're dealing with people that have different lives, different stories, different habits and behaviors that they've used to navigate their lives, right? Yeah. And so you're trying that refrain that we constantly use, you meet them where they are, you're meeting them where they're unique. I mean, I've had patients, and I'm sure you've had this, where you're sitting and having a conversation and they immediately dissociate. And then you're like, oh, okay, let's see if we can ground them, you know, get them feels, because this is where the conversation ends, right? We're going to try and see if we can promote safety in that moment, because that's all that matters really at that moment. But I get excited, like in our pain self-management program, we do a lot of work around somatic tracking and pain reprocessing. Not that we're just, and I tell patients all the time, because I'm not saying, I say to patients, if you still feel that you need to understand why that pain is there and you want to keep looking for an answer, you should do that. And I'm not saying that you should give up any of your therapies. In fact, I tell patients never give up their therapies until they go through the pain self-management program. And then often they come up to me then and they'll say, you know what, I really want to come off these medications. So they feel more motivated, right?
It's often, you know, when you can take someone, when you can help someone come off opioids, especially in like patients on really high doses, whether it's with buprenorphine or just a very gradual taper, it's amazing how, not always, but it's amazing how for many patients, their pain improves, their mood or quality of life improves. And sometimes it's only with the benefit of hindsight that they realize that these drugs that they thought, well, they were rightly thought were essential, were actually part of the problem.
What we do here in Nova Scotia, I'm not sure if they do it in Ontario. So any new physician that comes into the province, I do education around the legacy patient. Mm-hmm. Because what was happening is that there were tons of complaints to the college of physicians cutting patients off.
Yeah.
You know, and what I always say to clinicians, it's not the patient's fault that they're on these medications. They were prescribed by a prescriber. The patient is just doing what they're doing. And yes, we recognize that it's probably higher than they want, but you've got to kind of start from that point and start to work and earn the trust of the patient. But one of the things that I always feel terrible for are clinicians that are coming in, physicians that are coming in from other countries where opioids are not prescribed.
Yes.
And how overwhelmed, because we have such a shortage of family docs now. So these physicians are going into these practices with these high opioid prescribing legacy patients. That's not the patient's fault. But I'm just sure, interested in how you communicate to those prescribers, because they are like freaking out and they're like, oh my God, like I would never even do this with cancer. I'm going to lose my license. I can't do this ethically. Do you have any suggestions for how we should communicate?
So we have a lot of trainees who trained in, you know, Ireland or whatever, and they come here and can't believe even nowadays with the decline in prescribing over the last 15 years, it's still kind of much. It's still a cultural thing. We rely on opioids in a way that is not consonant with the evidence. I think the most important thing is helping docs realize that let's take a patient, just a contrived example of someone who's been on 400 milligrams of morphine chronically for, I don't know, severe chronic pain of one kind or another. I think it's important for docs to realize that just how important dependence and withdrawal are. I think they know this, but the idea that you're going to do anything good by taking the pills away or by rapidly cutting the dose down to some magical threshold of, let's say, 90 MMEs that really was meant to apply only to new starts. If you understand how destabilizing that's going to be, how that's a real rug pull. I mean, you just pull the these patients, people will think about taking their own lives if you do that to them.
Yeah. Well, we've
It's
actually had evidence that they've taken their lives, and haven't we seen more mortality and also going into the illicit.
very it's complicated, but there's just no doubt that opioid withdrawal is an intensely dysphoric, depressive, and sometimes and suicidality is a perfectly foreseeable consequence of taking somebody. So these patients are in a bad state, but we make it worse if we take their meds away. And
Yes.
so I will happily defend in a lawsuit any doc who, continues opioid therapy while trying to have discussions, and these are hard discussions to have,
Yeah.
about the potential benefits of a gradual taper. A lot of patients don't want to hear that. They don't want anything to do with the taper. I think that, to me, is a witness test, a litmus test for a poorly concealed opioid use disorder, iatrogenic opioid use
Yeah.
disorder. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I was just thinking because it brings me to the other point. Because the other thing that's not happening clinically is that there is no monitoring of these controlled substances. When you bring up the concept of, should we be doing urine? I'm interested in your opinion on this because I think about how do we minimize harm, but how do we help the patient understand risk? Because even when I've had no, numerous situations where I just integrated into my practice, but you're doing a baseline and obviously it depends on what type of test you're doing, but your baseline immunoassay, which is also always just a presumptive positive or negative, then you're sending it for your tandem spec, but where you're seeing like nothing in the urine, and so that obviously is concerning. It doesn't happen that often, but it does happen. And we're talking very high doses. So one of the things that I try to stress to clinicians, especially when they're taking on legacy patients, is how do you normalize, monitoring and screening without creating judgment, right? That you're making, just like you're doing an INR with warfarin. How do you create that normality? Or do you recommend that? What do you recommend?
Okay, so I might not be the best person to answer this question. I don't have, I look after hospitalized inpatients. I don't have a
Oh,
chronic
okay.
practice. And
Yeah.
so I might not have the best answer to that question.
When patients get admitted, David, who are opiate tolerant, do you do a routine urine drug test prior to
Oh, no,
admission?
absolutely not.
Okay.
How is that going to change my management? It would, in the
No,
scenario you
I'm just saying
described, right?
what you might see if you doesn't change. Okay.
No, I mean, I'm also a toxicologist, and we just waste so much money on these tests, which are prone to false positives and false negatives. I will say I've seen patients over the years who have been prescribed, Oxy 80 TID back in the day and just never had any Oxy in their urine, and they're selling it. I mean, they're selling it to make a buck,
Or
right?
even if you see, like what I see sometimes, because when I see methadone appear, because obviously your immunoassay is a little bit more sensitive for methadone and cocaine, obviously. So for me, it's not, and I'm not using it to judge. I'm using it to create a dialogue or a conversation, because I see that as somebody that's trying to manage. Because patients that develop opiate use disorder from the medical use are not thinking that they're going to develop a substance use disorder. They have a real pain syndrome, right? And so, but inadvertently, if they're not being monitored or we're not having these conversations and they develop an opiate use disorder, that's when they usually get abandoned because somehow it's
It's
the
very
patient's
dangerous.
fault. Yeah.
Well, it's not
And
the patient's
so
fault. No.
how do we integrate that into a, because I do think it needs to happen. I mean, my patients are managing not, I mean, I do inpatient, but all mostly outpatient. And I do feel that it becomes an personally that, and not to catch patients, but it lets patients know that we care enough to create safety around how these medicines are used for them, their family, for the community. But I, so if, yeah, so I'm just curious.
I don't know. I think it's important at the outset of opioid therapy that patients be, you know, be made aware of the fact that these drugs, and it's not hyperbole to say,
yeah,
these drugs can hijack your brain.
Exactly.
And they can
hijack your life.
They can hijack your life. And it's incumbent upon us. That's why it's so critical that we, as the people who hold the keys, who write the prescriptions, be careful with them. All of the problems with opioids are dose dependent and duration dependent. And so I think we shouldn't be starting them without a plan to stop them, unless, of course, different at end of life. But we shouldn't, we should think about dose escalation as not something that we just should sort of, we should view the urge to increase the dose as a barometer of therapeutic failure, right? And maybe if what you're doing is not working, stop doing it, rather than just going up on the dose. That's how we get patients into trouble. In patients, it's obviously a much more difficult conversation in a legacy patient who has begun to develop, you know, aberrant opioid, you know, behaviors, whether pills, why is it always the hydromorph that seems to fall down the sink, not the naproxen? That sort of thing. That's a very nuanced and challenging discussion. And I will say some of the most difficult conversations I have as a physician are with people who, and I have fewer of them now than I did 15 years ago, but they're with people who are on chronic opioid therapy and they are obviously being harmed by it. And they will not brook a discussion about that or about the potential benefits of tapering. It's very, you know, sometimes you have those discussions and you win the patient's trust and you help them taper or maybe even rotate to buprenorphine. And sometimes the quality of life and pain improvement are just unbelievable. But more often than not, you're just, it's like talking to a brick wall. And that's our fault for doing that.
Yeah. So if you make that assumption that the patient may be using their opioids in a way that is harmful, what do you think is a reasonable response of a clinician who is managing that patient in that moment?
First of all, I think firing them is terrible. I think we must not let them go into withdrawal. Right. I mean, we're not vending machines, but these patients have grossly disturbed neurophysiology. And if they go into withdrawal, they are either going to take their own life or they're going to go to the street or who knows what. Right. But I think that patient probably, you know, ideally they need to come under the care of a person, you know, a combination of pain psychologist and someone who treats complex chronic pain and addiction. And that's, I guess you're someone like that, but there are, it's hard to find dogs like that.
What I often inform clinicians. So say I always say never cut the patient off, whatever you do, do not cut the patient off.
Right.
The safest thing to do in that moment, and you can explain to the patient that it's going to be temporary, is you put them on daily dispensing. That doesn't have to be witnessing because then they're not using compulsively. Right. That brings me to another point is when I see prescriptions for like 90 days, and I think, okay, let's just step back. So I understand that, yeah, it could be convenient for the patient, but let's just think about the drug and just think about the condition. And so if your patient has 90 days access to these very powerful medications and they're developing tolerance and dependency and experiencing withdrawal, then the risk of them taking more, it makes sense. It's not their fault that they're running out. So for me, I always say scripts. You shouldn't be more than 30 days. But I mean, if I feel that patient is at risk of dying because now they've developed the substance use disorder and they're, you know, running out early and things, and it's a daily dispensing for me until we can figure out what to do next.
Yeah.
And that requires obviously conversations. But
yeah. So daily dispensing is sort of it's kind of an extreme measure, but it makes a lot of intuitive sense because it helps reframe for the patient. Wow, this is different. This is not what I planned when I started these medications, right?
Yeah, and it is a cost, but we're trying to, you know, you usually can advocate with the pharmacy and say, look, I'm just really concerned about their well-being right now, and this is where we need to have a conversation, and I don't want them running out. I don't want them in withdrawal. Generally. But I mean, obviously when a substance use disorder develops, it doesn't matter how many buckets of opioids I give them, I'm not going to get their pain under control.
Right.
So I just need to kind of reframe and reset.
I think 90 days supply. I mean, somewhere out there is a so-called legitimate pain patient / legacy patient who is adamant that 90 days supply is fine. And they're not they will take exactly as directed and they will come in for the refill at day 89. And there are people who do that. right? That does not mean they aren't being harmed by therapy. It just means they're not using it in an aberrant fashion.
Well, we don't know if they're diverting though.
Oh, okay. I'm referring.
This is where I think sometimes pill towns and eventuality. Those big scripts.
I'm talking about the patient who's just following the doctor's orders, right? The patient who is they don't have any kind of glimmer of aberrant opioid use. They view themselves as a legacy patient, and these drugs are essential to life, and they're following the doctor's orders exactly, and they're not taking more than they should. They're not coming in for early refills. Like, those people are out there. And I think that they too would very often benefit from a talk about a gradual taper rotation to buprenorphine. They don't maybe like that sometimes. But once they start exhibiting aberrant behaviors, and it's not rare, right? It's actually quite common.
It is very common.
And that's not the patient's fault, but the drugs alter the person's neurophysiology, and we have some sense of this patient might be more prone to this by virtue of a mental health history or some other addiction or whatever. But this happens to people with no sort of red flag. This happens to people who you have no reason to believe a priori are going to develop problematic opioid use. It just happens sometimes.
Even patients who develop a substance use disorder or a behavioral use disorder are not planning to develop that. That's when we start to rewire how our neural circuitry and how that reward system is starting to work. I'm just curious about if you had control of the system, right? With your knowledge background, with your expertise, your true understanding of this, how would you redesign the system from scratch? I'm just thinking about how we do risk stratification and how we prescribe. Like, I always come back to anticoagulation because to me it makes, we have a CHAD2 score, we have our score.
That's a very open-ended question. I could go any number of ways. I think that I won't focus just on opioids, but a system where it's easier to get access to non-medical therapies, right? Pills are covered. Patients want pain gone. Most of us went to medical school to help people. Involves the relief of suffering. Prescribing pills is just it gives the impression of doing something. It very frequently works. It helps you get on to the next patient. I think it would be nice if non-medical therapies were, if not equally accessible, more accessible than they are. But when it comes to opioids, I think it would be, what would we do differently? I think we would, interesting. I think it would, it should be harder to prescribe opioids than it is. This is for new starts.
Yes.
I think breaking people up into those on opioids and those not on opioids, let's focus for a second. For the opioid naive patients, I think it should be harder to prescribe opioids. Someone first day out of medical school can write a prescription for, 90 tablets of hydromorphone, CR, and without really realizing just how much they think they're helping, and they don't realize how much harm they're doing. So healthcare professionals, doctors, nurse practitioners, pharmacists would be better educated on the harms of opioids and understand that these drugs are not nearly as safe or not nearly as effective as we have been brainwashed into thinking by a 30-year-long experiment on the North American population that began with good intentions, but a lot of money backed by Purdue and other companies to try and change the culture. And the culture change, while it's still there, we still, doctors still perceive opioids as our best, strongest pain relievers. It's just not true. Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's also for me, it's more about, it's not the output. It's not for me. It's not, even though we focus on the protective output, which is pain, we often have to look upstream. Right. We have to look at the biological threat and the CNS threats. So, I've had many situations in the emergency room where a patient comes in a wheelchair and they're hunched over and they're just in excruciating pain. Yeah. And I go in and see them and sit down with them. And we sort of start to get an idea. I'm trying to look for patterns. Is there something biologically going on with this patient? And in the end, it turns out that the patient is absolutely terrified that they're pregnant. right? And so you start to understand where the threat is coming from. I haven't even examined this person yet. And I'm like, oh, wow, I'm so glad that you shared that with me. And literally just did like, so sometimes it's not, we get so focused on the protective, and understandably so, that's how we're trained. But it's also understanding what's going on and seeing what kind of patterns we're dealing with. Sometimes we can aggressively, because we do have nursing orientated protocols. And sometimes if I can't have the conversation with the patient, you know, you give them something so that you can get that threat down so you can have a better idea of what's going on with the patient. But this was a situation where I was like, whoa, okay. So I went right in because they looked like they were in a lot of distress and just started talking. And that's what it, and she literally eventually got up off. So was that pain real? Absolutely. She, I mean, regardless of where the threat is coming from, the protective output is pain, right? So it's really trying to figure out where this is coming from. And I mean, there's obviously that classic story in medical literature of the construction worker who stepped on a nail, right? And nails through the boot and just excruciating pain, gets rushed to the emergency room. They get there and he hasn't even had a scratch, right? And so what did it mean his pain wasn't real? No, his pain was real. It's just that the output was not, was basically how he did that assessment, right? Very quickly and said, well, of course I'm going to have like a nail through my foot, right? So I, you know, so for me, it doesn't mean that I delay treatment. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I, one thing I love to do is to manage pain and suffering, but I also realize, especially in my work as a, you know, palliative care physician, eMERGE doc, is that suffering comes in different forms. And so even how we use things like pain scales, like to me, I have to switch those to suffering scales because then it broadens the landscape, right? Because if I think of pain scales, all I'm thinking is biological threat.
There's an important distinction between pain and suffering. We've all seen people who can endure what seems like a lot of pain, and they seem to somehow manage it. So they're not synonyms.
Well, it's what is going on in that threat landscape that I think becomes really important. And I always say to students as well, and this always comes up, and because I do this every friggin' day, is I always check in with my own threat landscape before I see the patient. Because oftentimes, especially in the emergency room where most of the demands are, is that I'm getting pulled in many directions and I haven't eaten, I'm sort of agitated, I might have just come from a resuscitation. And so I have to check in with my own threat landscape before I walk into that room. And I've seen myself actually stop, pause, especially because in a small community, you know patients, right? So you know who's going to require your attention and your time. So I often, it means going to take a break or even getting something to eat before I even see the patient. Because you know, we are humans. We're not superhumans. Anyway, David, I didn't know if you have any final thoughts and I'll let you go, but I thank you so much for talking with me.
It was my pleasure. I think we covered a lot of ground. It's complicated. It's very nuanced. It's not the sort of thing that you can discuss on Twitter without, without getting yelled at. But I think we've touched on some important concepts. And I think the message for doctors and patients alike is, I think the key message is these drugs are a lot, they're valuable, but they're not as effective or as safe as we think. And a lot of the side effects fly under the radar. And if I had to pick on one again, it would be dependence. Because honestly, with the, after 5 or 7 days of around the clock opioid therapy, these drugs are hard to stop. And so the, you know, doctors shouldn't be starting without a plan to stop them. And patients should realize that they adapt to these drugs in a way that can make them look like they're continuing to be effective when they're actually not really helping you at all. So I think that would be, if I had one message to leave people with, that would be it. So.
Well, and I think that I'm going to just accentuate what you're saying, because the important point is that dependency happens in days. We're not talking months.
Yes, right.
And addiction takes months.
Yeah,
but dependency is in days. And so that, I don't think people understand that even tolerance is in days in a regular user. Right.
Yes.
So, I mean, yeah, it's just crazy.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. Tolerance, people will recognize this happens with alcohol, too, but it happens immediately. And so there's a phenomenon called the Mellenby effect, where people who drink alcohol might notice that they feel a little bit more inebriated on the way up than on the way, for a given blood alcohol concentration, people feel more inebriated on the way up than on the way down. And that is just a bit of acclimatization, even within a single session to alcohol. any drug that hits a pleasurable receptor, whether it's an opioid or alcohol or benzo, has the same phenomenon. So yeah, all these side effects, we think about them as long-term things. They start to get their teeth in the patient with the first couple of doses.
Yeah, well, I always say the other thing, we'll leave it at this, but our brain is always motivated in moving towards survival, protection, and safety. And so safety is often found in the substance itself. So if we think about how we're hardwired, it's survival, protection, and moving towards safety. The brain does not like chaos. It wants to find a safe place. And so if we give them a safe place, that becomes the safe place. So using other strategies before we kind of land there is so important. 100%. Anyway, I'm going to let you go because we could talk forever.
Thanks, Maureen.